2. Every age fraught with discord and danger seems to spawn a leader meant only for that age, a political giant whose absence, in retrospect, seems inconceivable when the history of that age is written. Mayna Gladstone was just such a leader for our final age, although none then could have dreamed that there would be no one but me to write the true history of her and her time. Gladstone had been compared to the classical figure of Abraham Lincoln so many times that when I was finally ushered into her presence that night of the Armada party, I was half surprised not to find her in a black frock coat and stovepipe hat. The CEO of the Senate and leader of a government serving 130 billion people was wearing a gray suit of soft wool, trousers and tunic top ornamented only by the slightest hint of red cord piping at seams and cuffs. I did not think she looked like Abraham Lincoln, nor like Alvarez Temp, the second most common hero of antiquity, cited as her doppelganger by the press. I thought that she looked like an old lady. Mayna Gladstone was tall and thin, but her countenance was more aquiline than Lincoln-esque, with her blunt beak of a nose, sharp cheekbones, the wide expressive mouth with thin lips, and gray hair rising in a roughly cropped wave, which did indeed resemble feathers. But to my mind, the most memorable aspect of Mayna Gladstone's appearance was her eyes, large, brown, and infinitely sad. We were not alone. I had been led into a long, softly lighted room lined with wooden shelves, holding many hundreds of printed books. A long hollow frame simulating a window gave a view of the gardens. A meeting was in the process of breaking up, and a dozen men and women stood or sat in a rough half-circle that held Gladstone's desk at its cusp. The CEO leaned back casually on her desk, resting her weight on the front of it, her arms folded. She looked up as I entered.
M. Severn?
Yes.
Thank you for coming.
Her voice was familiar from a thousand all-thing debates, its timbre rough with age, and its tone as smooth as an expensive liqueur. Her accent was famous, blending precise syntax with an almost forgotten lilt of pre-Hegira English, evidently now found only in the river delta regions of her home world of Potoffa.
"Gentlemen and ladies, let me introduce M. Joseph Severn," she said.
Several of the group nodded, obviously at a loss as to why I was there. Gladstone made no further introductions, but I touched the datasphere to identify everyone. 3 cabinet members, including the Minister of Defense, 2 force chiefs of staff, 2 aides to Gladstone, 4 senators, including the influential Senator Kolchev, and a projection of a Technocorps counselor known as Albedo.
M. Severn has been invited here to bring an artist's perspective to the proceedings, said CEO Gladstone.
Force Ground General Moore Purgo snorted a laugh.
An artist's perspective? With all due respect, CEO, what the hell does that mean?
Gladstone smiled. Instead of answering the general, she turned back to me.
What do you think of the passing of the Armada, M. Severn?
It's pretty, I said.
General Moore Purgo made a noise again.
Pretty? He looks at the greatest concentration of Space Force firepower in the history of the galaxy and calls it pretty?
He turned toward another military man and shook his head. Gladstone's smile had not wavered.
And what of the war? She asked me. Do you have an opinion on our attempt to rescue Hyperion from the ouster barbarians?
It's stupid, I said. The room became very silent. Current real-time polling in the All Thing showed 98% approval of CEO Gladstone's decision to fight rather than cede the colonial world of Hyperion to the ousters. Gladstone's political future rested on a positive outcome of the conflict. The men and women in that room had been instrumental in formulating the policy, making the decision to invade, and carrying out the logistics. The silence stretched.
Why is it stupid? Gladstone asked softly.
I made a gesture with my right hand. The hegemony's not been at war since its founding 7 centuries ago, I said. It is foolish to test its basic stability this way.
Not at war, shouted General Morpurgo. He gripped his knee with massive hands. What the hell do you call the Glennon Height Rebellion?
A rebellion, I said. A mutiny, a police action. Senator Kolchev showed his teeth in a smile that held no amusement. He was from Lussis and seemed more muscle than man.
Fleet actions, he said. 500,000 dead, 2 force divisions locked in combat for more than a year. Some police action, son.
I said nothing. Lee Hunt, an older, consumptive-looking man, reported to be Gladstone's closest aide, cleared his throat. But what M. Severn says is interesting. Where do you see the difference between this, conflict and the Glennon Height Wars, sir? Glennon Height was a former force officer, I said, aware that I was stating the obvious. The ousters have been an unknown quantity for centuries. The rebels' forces were known, their potential easily gauged. The ouster swarms have been outside the web since the Hegira. Glennon Height stayed within the Protectorate, raiding worlds no farther than 2 months' time debt from the web. Hyperion is 3 years from Parvati, the closest web staging area.
You think we haven't thought of all this? Asked General Morpurgo. What about the Battle of Brescia? We've already fought the ousters there. That was no rebellion.
Quiet, please, said Lee Hunt. Go on, M. Severn. I shrugged again. The primary difference is that in this case we are dealing with Hyperion, I said. Senator Richaud, one of the women present, nodded as if I had explained myself in full.
You're afraid of the Shrike, she said. Do you belong to the Church of the Final Atonement?
No, I said. I'm not a member of the Shrike cult.
What are you?
Demanded Morpurgo. An artist, I lied. Lee Hunt smiled and turned to Gladstone.
I agree that we needed this perspective to sober us, CEO, he said, gesturing toward the window and the hollow images showing the still applauding crowds. But while our artist friend has brought up necessary points, they have all been reviewed and weighed in full.
Senator Kolchev cleared his throat.
I hate to mention the obvious, when it seems we are all intent on ignoring it. But does this gentleman have the proper security clearance to be present at such a discussion?
Gladstone nodded and showed the slight smile so many caricaturists had tried to capture. M. Severn has been commissioned by the Arts Ministry to do a series of drawings of me during the next few days or weeks. The theory is, I believe, that these will have some historical significance and may lead to a formal portrait. At any rate, M. Severn has been granted a T-level gold security clearance, and we may speak freely in front of him. Also, I appreciate his candor. Perhaps his arrival serves to suggest that our meeting has reached its conclusion. I will join you all in the war room at 0800 hours tomorrow morning, just before the fleet translates to Hyperion space. The group broke up at once. General Morpurgo glowered at me as he left. Senator Kolchev stared with some curiosity as he passed. Councillor Albedo merely faded into nothingness. Lee Hunt was the only one besides Gladstone and me to remain behind. He made himself more comfortable by draping one leg over the arm of the priceless pre-Hegira chair in which he sat.
"Sit down," said Hunt.
I glanced at the CEO. She had taken her seat behind the massive desk, and now she nodded. I sat in the straight-backed chair General Morpurgo had occupied. CEO Gladstone said,
"Do you really think that defending Hyperion is stupid?"
"Yes." Gladstone steepled her fingers and tapped at her lower lip. Behind her, the window showed the Armada party continuing in silent agitation. "If you have any hope of being reunited with your, counterpart," she said, "it would seem to be in your interest for us to carry out the Hyperion campaign." I said nothing. The window view shifted to show the night sky still ablaze with fusion trails.
"Did you bring drawing materials?" asked Gladstone. I brought out the pencil and small sketch pad I had told Diana Philomel I did not have.
"Draw while we talk," said Mayna Gladstone.
I began sketching, roughing in the relaxed, almost slumped posture, and then working on the details of the face. The eyes intrigued me. I was vaguely aware that Leigh Hunt was staring intently at me.
"Joseph Severn," he said. "An interesting choice of names."
I used quick, bold lines to give the sense of Gladstone's high brow and strong nose.
"Do you know why people are leery of cybrids?" Hunt asked.
"Yes," I said. "The Frankenstein monster syndrome. Fear of anything in human form that is not completely human. It's the real reason androids were outlawed, I suppose."
"Uh-huh," agreed Hunt. "But cybrids are completely human, aren't they?"
"Genetically they are," I said. I found myself thinking of my mother, remembering the times I had read to her during her illness. I thought of my brother Tom. "But they are also part of the core," I said, "and thus fit the description of not completely human."
"Are you part of the core?" asked Mayna Gladstone, turning full face toward me.
I started a new sketch.
"Not really," I said.
"I can travel freely through the regions they allow me in, but it is more like someone accessing the datasphere than a true core personality's ability." Her face had been more interesting in three-quarters profile, but the eyes were more powerful when viewed straight on. I worked on the latticework of lines radiating from the corners of those eyes. Mayna Gladstone, obviously, had never indulged in Poulsen treatments.
"If it were possible to keep secrets from the core," said Gladstone, "it would be folly to allow you free access to the councils of government. As it is..." She dropped her hands and sat up. I flipped to a new page.
"As it is," said Gladstone, "you have information I need. Is it true that you can read the mind of your counterpart, the first retrieval persona?"
"No," I said.
It was difficult to capture the complicated interplay of line and muscle at the corners of her mouth. I sketched in my attempt to do so, moved on to the strong chin, and shaded the area beneath the underlip. Hunt frowned and glanced at the CEO. M. Gladstone brought her fingertips together again.
"Explain," she said.
I looked up from the drawing.
"I dream," I said. "The contents of the dream appear to correspond to the events occurring around the person carrying the implant of the previous Keats persona."
"A woman named Braun Lamia," said Leigh Hunt.
"Yes."
Gladstone nodded. "So the original Keats persona, the one thought killed on Lussis, is still alive?" I paused.
"He is still aware," I said.
"You know that the primary personality substrate was extracted from the core, probably by the cybrid himself, and implanted in a Schrone-Loop bio-shunt carried by M. Lamia."
"Yes, yes," said Leigh Hunt. "But the fact is, you are in contact with the Keats persona, and through him with the Shrike Pilgrims."
Quick, dark strokes provided a dark background to give the sketch of Gladstone more depth. "I am not actually in contact," I said. "I dream dreams about Hyperion that your Fatline broadcasts have confirmed as conforming to real-time events. I cannot communicate to the passive Keats persona, nor to its host or the other pilgrims." CEO Gladstone blinked.
"How did you know about the Fatline broadcasts?"
"The consul told the other pilgrims about his comlog's ability to relay through the Fatline transmitter in his ship. He told them just before they descended into the valley."
Gladstone's tone hinted of her years as a lawyer before entering politics.
"And how did the others respond to the consul's revelation?" I put the pencil back in my pocket.
"They knew that a spy was in their midst," I said.
"You told each of them." Gladstone glanced at her aide. Hunt's expression was blank.
"If you're in touch with them," she said, "you must know that we've received no message since before they left Keep Kronos to descend to the Time Tombs."
I shook my head.
Last night's dream ended just as they approached the valley. Mayna Gladstone rose, paced to the window, raised a hand, and the image went black. So you don't know if any of them are still alive?
No.
What was their status the last time you... dreamt? Hunt was watching me as intensely as ever. Mayna Gladstone was staring at the dark screen, her back to both of us. All of the pilgrims were alive, I said, with the possible exception of Hetmastine, the true voice of the tree.
He was dead? Asked Hunt.
He disappeared from the wind wagon on the sea of grass 2 nights before, only hours after the ouster scouts had destroyed the tree ship Yggdrasil. But shortly before the pilgrims descended from Keep Kronos, they saw a robed figure crossing the sands toward the tombs.
Hetmastine? Asked Gladstone.
I lifted a hand. They assumed so. They were not sure. Tell me about the others, said the CEO. I took a breath. I knew from the dreams that Gladstone had known at least two of the people on the last Shrike pilgrimage. Braun Lamia's father had been a fellow senator, and the hegemony consul had been Gladstone's personal representative in secret negotiations with the ousters. Father Hoyt is in great pain, I said. He told the story of the cruciform. The consul learned that Hoyt also wears one, two actually, Father Duray's and his own. Gladstone nodded. So he still carries the resurrection parasite?
Yes.
Does it bother him more as he approaches the Shrike's lair?
I believe so, I said.
Go on.
The poet Silenus has been drunk much of the time. He is convinced that his unfinished poem predicted and determines the course of events.
On Hyperion? Asked Gladstone, her back still turned.
Everywhere, I said.
Hunt glanced at the chief executive and then looked back at me.
Is Silenus insane?
I returned his gaze but said nothing. In truth, I did not know.
Go on, Gladstone said again.
Colonel Cassad continues with his twin obsessions of finding the woman named Minetta and of killing the Shrike. He is aware that they may be one and the same.
Is he armed?
Gladstone's voice was very soft.
Yes. Go on.
Saul Weintraub, the scholar from Barnard's world, hopes to enter the tomb called the Sphinx as soon as...
Excuse me, said Gladstone.
But is his daughter still with him?
Yes.
And how old is Rachel now?
5 days, I believe.
I closed my eyes to remember the previous night's dream in greater detail.
Yes, I said, 5 days.
And still aging backward in time.
Yes.
Go on, M. Severn. Please tell me about Braun Lamia and the consul.
M. Lamia is carrying out the wishes of her former client and lover, I said.
The Keats persona felt it was necessary for him to confront the Shrike. M. Lamia is doing it in his stead.
M. Severn, began Lee Hunt, you speak of the Keats persona as if it had no relevance or connection to your own.
Later, please, Lee, said Mayna Gladstone. She turned to look at me. I'm curious about the consul. Did he take his turn at telling his reason for joining the pilgrimage?
Yes, I said.
Gladstone and Hunt waited. The consul told them about his grandmother, I said. The woman called Ciri, who started the Maui Covenant Rebellion more than half a century ago. He told them about the death of his own family during the battle for Brescia, and he revealed his secret meetings with the ousters.
Is that all? Asked Gladstone.
Her brown eyes were very intense.
No,
I said. The consul told them that he had been the one to trigger an ouster device which hastened the opening of the time tombs. Hunt sat up straight, his leg dropping off the arm of the chair. Gladstone visibly took a breath.
Is that all?
Yes.
How did the others respond to his revelation of betrayal? She asked.
I paused, tried to reconstruct the dream images in a more linear fashion than memory provided. Some were outraged, I said. but none feels overwhelming loyalty to the hegemony at this point. They decided to go on. I believe that each of the pilgrims feels that punishment will be dealt out by the Shrike, not by human agency. Hunt slammed his fist down on the arm of the chair.
If the consul were here, he snapped, he'd fast discover otherwise.
Quietly. Gladstone paced back to her desk, touched some papers there. All of the comm lights were glowing impatiently. I found myself amazed that she could spend so much time talking to me at such an hour. Thank you, M. Severn, she said. I want you to be with us for the next few days. Someone will show you to your suite in the residential wing of Government House. I rose. I'll return to Esperance for my things, I said.
No need, said Gladstone. They were brought here before you had stepped off the Terminex platform. Lee will show you out.
I nodded and followed the taller man toward the door.
Oh, M. Severn, called Mayna Gladstone.
Yes?
The CEO smiled. I did appreciate your candor earlier, she said. But from this point on, let us assume you are a court artist, and a court artist alone, sans opinions, sans visibility, sans mouth.
Understood?
Understood, M. Executive, I said.
Gladstone nodded, already turning her attention to the blinking phone lights.
Very good. Please bring your sketchbook to the meeting in the war room at 0800 hours.
A security guard met us in the anteroom and started to lead me toward the maze of corridors and checkpoints. Hunt called out for him to stop and strode across the wide hall, his steps echoing on the tile. He touched my arm.
Make no mistake, he said. We know. She knows who you are and what you are and whom you represent.
I met his gaze and calmly extracted my arm.
That's good, I said.
Because at this point, I am quite sure that I do not know.